This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark. I'm joined here with William Costello. He's a writer from Ireland, postgraduate studying evolutionary psychology at Brunel University in London. And he has an article out, Step Your Dick Up, Why Incels Need Better Advice. William, it's great speaking with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Happy to speak with you.
To start things off, I discovered your work via the podcast from Non McCage Show, but if you want to give some background information about yourself.
So, just a little bit of brief background about myself. I moved from Ireland to England in 2011 to study English and education for an undergraduate degree. I followed this up with a postgraduate degree in career guidance. And for the last number of years, I've been developing software, a career guidance software platform to help students make decisions about their work, about what kind of career they'd want to go into. And during my work, it involved a long commute, and I essentially turned my car into a little mobile university and listening to audiobooks and podcasts and things like this. And the content I kept gravitating back towards was always evolutionary psychology. So this year, I decided to go back and started my master's at Brunel University in evolutionary psychology, and I'm loving it so far. It's going great. And the focus of my thesis is likely going to be around the topic of incels. The reason for that is because over the summer, I also began to start writing opinion pieces on various different topics, like cultural topics like gender politics, feminism, men's rights kind of issues. And one of the articles I wrote that gathered the most traction was this article that was provocatively titled, Step Your Dick Up, Why Incels Deserve Better Advice. So that's just a brief bit of background about myself and how I got interested in talking about evolutionary psychology and incels from that perspective.
Why did you initially decide to study incels?
So I became aware of the incel phenomenon on a personal level at a conference in London in 2018. It was the Messages for Men men's rights kind of conference, and at that conference I heard an incel speak publicly in person for the first time. I had only very kind of loosely heard about the phenomenon up until then, and hearing this incel kind of stand up at the front of the audience and speak, he spoke about it was obvious that he was overcoming crippling anxiety to kind of address the audience, and he spoke about the tension he has and the annoyance and frustration he has hearing the advice that's given to him. He gets frustrated hearing the advice, just be yourself, and also to just lift, bro, which is a common piece of kind of magic bullet style advice that apparently incels are given, to just lift weights, and apparently this will solve all their problems. Now this, I could hear the frustration in his voice, and it kind of got me thinking about, well, you know, what advice would be given to incels, and what are the messages we receive, we send to incels, and why might that be insufficient, demeaning, and that's what my article aimed to explore in more detail.
What was some of the traction from the article? Positive reactions, any criticism, and are you optimistic about a dialogue across the aisle?
So interestingly, my article was somewhat positively received by incels, by normies and by even some feminists alike. So I don't know whether that's an indication that my work is doing something good or something bad. Hopefully if your listeners read the article, they'll think that it's something good. The response has been kind of strange. It obviously is such a provocative topic that it's going to receive some criticism. Some of the interesting criticism that it received is that normally kind of some extremely kind and gentler type politics people, when you begin to talk to them about incels, they turn very cruel and all sympathy kind of goes out the window. I think it's important, you know, I care about incels because I feel they're misrepresented due to the most extreme voices within the community. And when this happens with other minority groups, when they're defined by extremists in their community, for example, the harmful stereotype of Muslims as terrorists, we kind of, as a society, rail against that. However, we're kind of reluctant to do that when regarding incels. And also, in society, we usually try and kind of help or at least have sympathy for the most disenfranchised minority groups, but we don't seem to do this with incels at all. Like I said, the response, I had usually kind commentators saying things like, life is hard, get over it, and they suddenly turn into the most hardline Ayn Rand philosophers and, you know, they have no sympathy at all. I think, you know, it's a very interesting kind of double criticism that the incel topic gets. I think men like to lampoon incels and kind of deride the topic because I think they feel that it indicates something kind of about their own sexual prowess. They almost think it comical that someone would forge an identity around such a level of inferiority.
I'm sure a lot of them feel under siege from both sides, from both kind of a more like liberal or woke side, but also from a more macho side simultaneously.
Absolutely, and this is interesting because obviously I feel that the manosphere or the online kind of men's community it's painted with too broad of a brush, and I think incels, like you said, get it from both sides. They get demeaned from other corners of the manosphere. And you know, when you hear the caricature of incels that you're given in society, oh, they just hate women. Well, I think they have a lot of resentment to women, but I think they also have a lot of resentment to wider society as well, not just narrowly women. You know, they might have resentment more broadly than that.
Yeah, there's like demonization in light of like the Toronto van attack, and James Bloodworth, I think that was the Unheard, he reviewed your article, and his point was like making that like first they lose out from society, and the next step is to expel them from respectable society altogether, just the overall demonization from media and academia. And what you're advocating is like overall kindness and compassion, but you'd say like overall there's more of an issue of like self-harm rather than harm to others, contrary to like the stereotypes and demonization.
Yeah, so obviously I kind of view the incel community as there's like concentric circles, and Sam Harris does a very good job of talking about the Islamic terrorism in this way, thinking about the different levels of kind of extremism within a community. So if you think that, you know, if you consider that the number of men who haven't been gaining access to sex or relationships within the last year has increased threefold in the last decade, we must conclude that the majority of incels are kind of peaceful and non-violent. But a significant minority do derive a sense of community, kind of, you know, speaking in misogynistic ways online. You know, and obviously the tragic rare cases of individual cases of incels have lashed out at society in horrific acts of violent rage. But obviously the media tends to fixate on those latter two groups, the online kind of vitriol and the tragic kind of terrorist style acts. You know, I'm reminded of the media kind of salivating at the prospect of the amount of incel violence that was surely going to happen around the Joker movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it just didn't manifest at all, you know, despite the media.
Well, what's interesting with the Joker movie is, like, if that were to come out, like, 20 years ago, it would have been perceived actually as a leftist movie, but it's interesting how much the culture has changed and, like, what defines one's political label.
Absolutely, yeah. You could view it through that lens, and perhaps 20 years ago it would have. But I think the world is very identity politics based now. So and it's very symbol based. So the Joker meme became a kind of totem of a very online, resentful, white male kind of identity, which is interesting from an incel perspective because they're kind of caricatured as kind of white and conservative, even though in actual fact it appears that the incelosphere is a lot more diverse than one might think.
Yeah, I think I saw a poll that says about half is non-white.
Right, okay. So, you know, I haven't looked into the specific numbers on it yet. Maybe I'd like to study that a little bit further even. But, yeah, it's certainly a lot more diverse than it's depicted. Interestingly, in response to my article, I had a feminist academic, Dr. Sarah Daly, reach out to me, and we've just actually released a YouTube episode together, and she's been great. We're planning a letter exchange around the topic. She's planning to write a book on incels. And one thing, just to pick up on your original point, that she mentioned was very significant, is that when we focus so much on all the online misogynistic shitposting that incels do to kind of, you know, maybe gather attention or just form in-group, out-group kind of identity. With all the focus on that stuff and all that outrage, what gets lost is the attention that should be on the loneliness, the depression, and the suicidality. That could be you know, at play in the incelosphere.
And yeah, with the subculture, like it's not just coping. It's they have their own terminology, unique dark sense of humor, and the sites provide a sense of a tribe, a sense of fraternity, and their own lexicon and their own sort of being part of an in group. Which in general, like there are pros and cons of that. But would you say overall the positives outweigh the negatives?
Well, it's difficult to know whether the positives outweigh the negatives. And, you know, I would always try and advocate that incels should ascend and try and maybe break free from the fatalistic black and white kind of thinking. But I would certainly say that who could blame them, so to speak, right? So you mentioned the idea of identity, and I think that's so important when you talk about incels, because it's a difficult thing to define what an incel is, because a time metric on how long someone hasn't had access to sex doesn't seem sufficient because, you know, there's a big difference between a dry spell and an incel, so to speak. So,
yeah, like I've seen one definition that anything over 6 months, but I think like the core of that community would probably say like, oh yeah, you're a fixed cell.
Right. Yeah, so in my reading of it is that you must embrace the identity to some extent to really, you know, we must kind of differentiate there between people who embrace the identity or people who are just haven't had sex for some time metric. And like you to pick up on your point, yeah, it's in many ways, who could blame them? It's crossed my mind that a lot of incels take such community, fraternity, and identity from the label and the community. Why would they leave that to engage in a kind of a dating market that they would see as ritualistically humiliating, exhausting, and quite expensive monetarily? You know, why would they run that gauntlet in the dating market? Why would they leave the incel identity?
I'm not sure if you saw Naomi Kate's interview on Escape Hate between Daryl Davis, who's an African-American man, and a former neo-Nazi, and discussing like the concept of hate groups. But one of the things that was brought up is like they do provide like a sense of social capital. And then a lot of times, like when people leave these groups, not necessarily saying it's the same as incels, but just in general, like they basically don't have that much, and mainstream society doesn't. Yeah, there are benefits of being in a tribe, and that's part of the reason why why people join groups that might be that are like extremist groups.
Oh, of course, there's a real sense of meaning, and they've also got the real or perceived sense of grievance and the common enemy. So if the only tool you've got is a hammer, everything in the world begins to look like a nail. And that's what I've found with a lot of incels I've engaged with online. They're almost probing you to reinforce their worldview and, you know, pushing you down. And in reality, I find that the world is a lot more complex than the black and white thinking of a lot of incels. But I think there is a nugget of truth to the grievances they have that society doesn't really, that society kind of demeans. And that's kind of the sweet spot I was trying to find in the article, is trying to find out, well, on what points do they have an element of real grievance, and we shouldn't just dismiss their issues. But also my kind of wider philosophy on it would be, I would try and encourage incels to escape or to ascend from the fatalistic type of thinking, that it's a lot more dynamic and in flux than they think.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers of incels have increased dramatically over the past decade. Like, do you have statistics and thoughts on why the reasons for the growth in this phenomenon? And is this incel phenomenon, is it global or confined to specific nations?
I haven't looked into specifically much about the breakdown of global and where it is more prominent and things like that, but I have some ideas about kind of certain aspects of the modern world that might be at play, that actually understanding evolutionary psychology might actually help us understand what's exacerbating this problem. So there's an E.O. Wilson quote that I really like that kind of gets to the heart of this problem. And he says, the real problem of humanity is the following. We have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. And I believe that there's been kind of unintended consequences of certain aspects of modernity that on the surface seem like intuitive net positives, such as the advent of online dating, women's liberation into the workplace, and the erosion of strict socially enforced monogamy. So I think all those things are kind of at play. So I don't know which one of those you'd like to talk about first.
Oh yeah, but first of all, do you think this phenomenon could have long-term psychological damage?
So yeah, I think in terms of an evolutionary perspective, we must remember that as evolutionary psychology would kind of explain, that our minds are still kind of in our ancestral environment, which in which we would have lived in small tribes or small bands of maybe around 100 to 150 people. So social rejection or sexual rejection could have meant been catastrophic to someone in our ancestral environment. So if you consider the compounding impact of the amount of rejection that an incel might actually have to endure, that what that might do to someone's psyche is quite incredible, you know. And you know, just to contend with the fact that for the first time this generation might actually have to contend with the fact that they know there could be an evolutionary dead end, that's a tall order to contend with psychologically, I imagine.
Yeah, why do you think that incels lose out in modern dating, and how would you contrast like the dating economy now with the past, even like with dating apps like Tinder? There's been a pretty dramatic change even over the past decade.
So yeah. So in terms of the online stuff, I think that's very important, because a study of first of all, there's been one study that shows that 40% of relationships, I think in America, are now started online.
Oh, I saw that chart. So it shows like more traditionally is through family or church, and that's minuscule today. And then meeting through bars, like that peaked in the 90s and that's declining. And you see like the chart, like a massive, it basically looks like the COVID chart with exponential growth, where meeting through online dating apps has gone way up.
Right. Okay. So yeah, and that exacerbates a lot of problems and kind of eliminates some of the dynamism or other routes that you might have been able to kind of find a partner through. One study of Tinder and found that the bottom 80% of men in terms of attractiveness are competing for the bottom 22% of women, and the top 80% of women are competing for the top 20% of men. So crudely put, the modern dating economy closer resembles what we'd call in evolutionary psychology, effective polygyny, where the most high status men, a small minority of the most high status men at the top, have a monopoly on the sexual interest of the majority of women, and the majority of men are just simply not being considered. Now, you know, this is, it might be just a kind of a an uncomfortable truth for us to engage with, that for a lot of human history, women had been maybe settling for men that they didn't really want out of economic necessity or out of strict kind of socially enforced monogamy norms. So it's very hard to imagine rowing that back. But it kind of left us with that kind of mismatch, which isn't really good for either, because I don't think women tend to like to share a small minority of men at the top. And I've actually had some very interesting back and forths on Twitter with what I would call tradcon feminists, who in their own words have described that they think sexual liberation has been a catastrophe for women, and that modern women are too naive to cope with the what they describe as fuckboys, of these kind of minority of men who are just kind of you know, using the system for their own benefit and taking advantage and manipulating. So it's you know, I find that a little bit of a vote of no confidence in modern women to be a little bit demeaning, and it kind of proves a long-standing theory that I have, that I actually like women and respect women a lot more than a lot of feminists.
Yeah, I mean, there's this sort of economic debate about, like, the gender pay gap, and then you have, like, there's just countless articles about, like, the shortage of marriageable men. I think you must have linked to one of them, like, Broke Men. Articles becoming a theme, and, yeah, I mean, there's a degree of hypocrisy, but this is, like, a major theme in a lot of newspapers. You see all these news articles and op-eds.
Yeah, it's framed a different way. So if women, you know, you had a media love-in for Emma Watson when she decided to become self-partnered because there aren't enough good men out there. And, you know, there really is a mismatch here in terms of what women want from their partners. So by their own romantic standards, there really aren't enough good men out there. For example, you know, a lot of women are doing brilliantly in the workplace now, and, you know, but a recent study on what kind of young women want from their relationships revealed that just 5% of women said they would like a relationship with a man who works part-time or doesn't work at all while they work full-time. So, you know, that's kind of leading to a mismatch. And even on Tinder, I believe there is another study that showed you're significantly more likely to gain positive matches with a master's level qualification in your profile than just a bachelor's degree. So this is all coming from evolutionary psychology as well, and something called parental investment theory. And it basically posits that women they're the far choosier sex, because males compete with each other to be chosen by the female, who, you know, and she has a lot more to lose if she invests in the wrong man, so to speak. So she's going to be a lot more discerning in her choice. So now her kind of tastes are ratcheting up, and there's something called hypergamy, which shows that women tend to like to mate in equal status or higher. And it's becoming a bit of a mismatch in terms of the supply and demand problem.
A lot of these trends took place over an era of relative prosperity. We're looking at an economic forecast that could be more bleak, but do you think that could have an impact on these trends?
Yeah, certainly, because like I say, even hypergamy, the way that works is, even if a woman is making a lot of money herself, she still wants the equal or higher earning partner. Traditionally, so if there is that supply and demand problem, you know, that's just gonna get worse and worse with the economic downturn.
Yeah, I'm hearing mixed things. Like some incels are maybe like coping. Could be like a cope that it might improve things, or you could see the same trends, but just based more on wealth rather than like physical appearance and non-monetary social status.
Well, I think where the TradCon feminists might have a point is that wherever you see a sex ratio in terms of, you know, a smaller minority of men that that women consider they would want to be with, and a large numbers of women, then that tends to favor the kind of whoever's in the minority. So what you see in situations like that is the large groups of women will begin behaving more promiscuously and things like this. And, you know, obviously the TradCon feminists don't really think this is a good thing, because anything that men enjoy as well as women, they don't tend to like.
And there's some people who would, like, trads who would call for a return to the past. And then I saw this video, which I sent you, of this manosphere type, Alexander Grave, posting a video about his prediction is that polygyny will be totally normalized in the near future.
It's a fascinating, it's fascinating to think that that might be the case, and that that might even come from a feminist lens. But it, you know, it's worth thinking about that, you know, this whole kind of monogamy, although it's led to the greatest period of human prosperity and kind of human flourishing, for 80% of our human societies have been in that polygynous mating strategy. So, you know, it's not completely difficult to believe it may happen, but what I think it might happen a lot more covertly, a lot less explicitly. So it'll happen whereby those high status men will just remain single. They just won't settle down, because why would they? You know, they have more to gain by playing the field and remaining single rather than settling down for one woman. And, you know, it's a lot of extra responsibility to kind of take on multiple wives. So you'd wonder, why would they, if they could keep things the same, why would they do it?
Yeah, you touch upon this in your article, Step Your Dick Up, Why Incels Deserve Better Advice. Like, there is limitations. Self-improvement, it's important as maybe a base, but it has limitations. And this kind of, like, pull yourself up by your bootstrap mentality, a lot of the mainstream advice, like the cliche of just be yourself, and the red pillars of the manosphere, they promote their own version of this too, and a lot of them are looking, like, to sell products, and, like, you have older solutions that don't work, and just in general, like, older generations are out of touch with current issues.
Absolutely. So, you know, there's kind of a number of different pieces of advice that I deal with in the article that get kind of given to incels. Number one is kind of be yourself, that will solve the problem, which I think that's kind of demeaning to the problem. And it kind of implies that A, that there is no problem at all for an incel, or B, that they're just being inauthentic. So it's kind of gaslighting to incels. To suggest that they should just be themselves and that will solve the problem. It's a very useless piece of advice. The next piece of advice, as we talked about, is just lift, bro. So the idea of lifting weights, and that's kind of demeaning to a lot of incels who report to have physical or mental disabilities.
Have you seen polls on, like, what percent do you have mental disabilities?
I've only seen self-reported statistics from incel forums. I quote one in my article, but I don't have it in front of me at the moment. Sorry, I can't remember exactly. Bear with me one second. I can't find the actual statistic, but it's in my article. A significant portion of them self-report.
Like Asperger's syndrome, autism, social anxiety.
Yeah, those kind of things, which, you know, the dating world is complex and kind of very socially sophisticated, and, you know, so that those kind of challenges are really significant to a lot of incels, you know. And it's you know, dealing with sexual rejection is a kind of a social pain that I feel is demeaned by much of wider society, because much of it is aimed at men in particular. I think there's one statistic I cite in my article that 90% of women would prefer the man to make the first move in terms of a sexual advance. And, you know, the kind of the dating arena is becoming fraught now with, you know, accusations, Me Too era. At some stage, a lot of incels or men are just going to decide to cut their losses and not participate anymore. and they'll increasingly retreat to online worlds, like online communities, like forums, but also to pornography, virtual reality, and OnlyFans, things like this, that kind of arrive at the same level of gratification, or similar, without the risk.
This is relevant to kind of greater social trends, and yeah, the idea that like one needs both a job and a wife to be a man and a stakeholder in society.
They've been the two, they kind of link together often, which is kind of unspoken about in polite society. You don't tend not to acknowledge that without the job, you often don't get the girl, which is interestingly because I have female friends who've actually, you know, they've dumped a man because he turned out to be a barista. He worked in a coffee shop, right? He was an otherwise perfect guy, and then my female friend dumped him when she heard about his job. You just can't really imagine that in reverse. It doesn't really happen. And actually, a woman's success in economically might actually be a red flag for a man, because she might be more inclined to leave him if he doesn't have success in his job. Which is, you know, we don't speak about that often. But yeah, certainly having a wife or having a partner and having a job are two big predictors of mental health in men, and both are kind of under threat now. And, you know, we can kind of demean this and say, boo-hoo, poor men, but that's really significant, you know, it's not good for anybody, because I subscribe to the philosophy of Dr. Warren Farrell, who his philosophy is that when one sex loses, both sexes lose. And we've kind of forgotten that we're allies to each other rather than kind of adversarial, as many in the gender politics.
So you see these trends as harmful to men, or do you see examples where they could be harmful to women in the long run?
Oh, certainly harmful to women in the long run as well, or even in the short term. I just don't, I think, you know, women I speak to, my friends and everybody, the men in their lives they like them, you know, they're not the enemy as they're kind of led to believe in the media. You know, they like their brothers, their cousins, their fathers, for the most part. You know, this whole men are trash meme just doesn't tack on, and it's kind of off-putting for a lot of women, I imagine.
Media, like if you spend so much time online in any echo chamber, regardless of which side it's on, like it doesn't always paint an accurate picture of actual relations in general.
Absolutely, yeah. And like I say, with the kind of, if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything begins to look like a nail. So to many in the men's rights community, everything in society begins to look like a gynocentric kind of feminized world. Whereas to feminists or to a lot of women, everything begins to look like an oppressive patriarchy.
And so people are spending like more time online than actual in social interactions.
Yeah, certainly. And I think that's only going to get worse because, you know, things like COVID happened. But also just the online world is becoming more seductive because it's less risky than engaging in the real world. And you can create whatever kind of identities you want. And I think that's going to get even more pronounced when, you know, virtual reality and kind of online pornography becomes more sophisticated. Because what that does for an incel, for example, is it gives him an evolutionary fake fitness cue. So if he is getting all the kind of cues from an online VR system that he's an evolutionary success, the message being sent to him is stay at home in your room with this virtual reality porn, because that's your best chance evolutionarily. It's a simulacrum. It kind of it's a fake facsimile, and it sends a fake fitness message. It's very interesting.
You posted Ed West's article on the Unheard about neo-feudalism, and it's I think he does touch upon the incel issue, but his general view is that this new kind of neo-feudal age is more of a result than technological changes rather than a deliberate political conspiracy. But what are your overall thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's very interesting, and he talks about the different ways in which the modern world is beginning to kind of mimic a lot of the kind of religiosity of days in the past, and that kind of religious fervor about tribalism, identity, cancelling people and kind of excommunicating them, are kind of resurfacing in different ways. The online stuff is kind of forging us into new tribes and kind of being the opinion makers for a lot of people. It's the human there is also something to think about in terms of just that the world has becoming so global, it's difficult for our brains to compute, because there's a theory in evolutionary psychology called Dunbar's number, which posits that the maximum kind of number of a community we're meant to form tribes around is about approximately 150. And if you consider the tribes that we've been forming around globally are so much bigger than that, it's amazing that we've been as peaceful as we have.
Yeah, like tribalism versus mass society. And then a lot of people, like, there's polls that show, like, your average person might only have like two or three close friends, but then they're connected to all of society and the internet, as opposed to how traditionally people lived, maybe in a community of like 50 to 100 people that they all knew.
That's right, yeah, and that's this whole idea of the kind of mismatch, and the human environment now. You know, if you take animals in a zoo, what you do is you try and create something as close to their natural habitat. And I don't like using this word natural for humans, because it implies that I think the past is good and natural, and it's kind of a naturalistic fallacy. But there is the environment of our ancestors, our ancestral environment is what our kind of brains and bodies are used to. But our environment now doesn't look anything like that. So if you took an animal in a zoo, the human animal, you wouldn't design an environment or a habitat for them that involved them sitting in front of a screen for 10 hours a day, hunched over with bad posture, with fake light down on top of them, not getting any vitamin D from the sun, not having any meaning for hunting, not having any close kinship relationships. It's a lot of it doesn't kind of feel fulfilling from what our bodies and minds are adapted, shaped and adapted to do.
Yeah, with your studies in evolutionary psychology, you wrote a paper defending the literary work of Tucker Max. But what are your overall thoughts on the kind of like Freudian theories about the degree that sex influences psychological motives within society, including politics?
Yeah, that's interesting. I wrote about Tucker Max. That was actually before I even had heard of evolutionary psychology at all, and I thought it was for my English degree that I actually defended the literary work of Tucker Max and the literary genre of fratire. And actually, looking back, that was more a kind of a defense of free expression rather than anything of psych. But Tucker Max did go on to host the evolutionary psychology podcast called The Mating Grounds with Dr. Jeffrey Miller. So it's interesting the kind of the tangents and the segues that kind of come back together. In terms of how much evolutionary psychology shapes our society, as far as I'm concerned, it's one of the only games in town, and that particularly for male behavior, we tend to follow what the female sexual selection system rewards. So I often joke with my female friends that if they want different behavior, they should reward different things.
It's the cliche of about that you hear from both red pill and black pill types of women who complain about certain male behavior, but they keep rewarding it. That's like a big cliche, but it's based in reality.
That's right, yeah. So another cliche to throw at you is we've heard that men treat women like sex objects, but women treat men like success objects. And they kind of, they're not queuing up to marry the stay-at-home dad. So, but they're kind of lamenting a gender pay gap in the workplace. But, so there's kind of that tension there that doesn't really add up. And, I saw something very strange lately. This woman put out on Twitter, which was a kind of a video of herself complaining that the reason women like tall men is men's fault, that that's the patriarchy's fault, because we have conditioned them to actually like taller men so that we can feel stronger and better about ourselves. And I just thought, you know, how demeaning to women that, you know, she thinks they can't even take credit for what they like. It just, I thought it was very interesting.
You wrote an article about tribalism and sports and racism as far as, like, views about racism and tribalism. Do you take the view that, there's one view that humans are born egalitarian and they learn to be bigoted through culture, and then there's another view that humans are psychologically wired through evolutionary psychology to be tribal. Which view do you tend to take?
Well, I certainly don't think we're a blank slate and that we're just filled in with culture from top down. You know, we're evolved to learn from culture. That's an evolutionary trait. Our brains became bigger the more sophisticated culture became, and then that encourages your brain to get bigger again as well. I definitely think we are wired to form tribes and form identities of in-groups and out-groups. That's certainly the case. Now, whether race is one of the best tribes around which that we form identities, the paper I wrote actually kind of refers to research that shows that the automaticity of race as a tribal marker can get erased almost when you actually bring in other identities. So, for example, I use sport because that is definitely an arena where race can kind of get transcended. If you've ever been on a sports team with different race players, you know that the primary identity is your sports team identity first and foremost, and the other team are the enemy, no matter what race they are. You know, obviously, it's a bit more complex than that, but your listeners can check out that article if we link to the show notes.
And you wrote a career division software, and if you can talk about that and just like kind of how we help people select jobs and how education works, how there's not enough guidance for a lot of people, and first of all, education, like everyone is expected to be good at everything from English to science and to math, and then also for kind of like how unemployment programs have not been that effective, like there hasn't really been an effective political mechanism within like either the state or the private sector to help people find jobs. So if you want to talk about your algorithm to help people find jobs that are suited for them, and your thoughts on just like the current system of credentialism, and do we need economic and educational system that is more specialized?
Yeah, so my role within the career guidance company that I worked for was to write the educational content for our career guidance software platform. So I can't claim to have anything to do with writing the algorithm or anything like that. But our software did do a bit of career matching, kind of helping people get ideas around suitable jobs that might want to aim at for them. But yeah, I just don't think that enough is done in education almost anywhere in the world around getting young people to see the bigger picture, that education is just part of their journey and it's leading somewhere, and they need to kind of put the stepping stones in place to make sure they do the right things along the way to get to where they want to go. And I'm not saying that every young person should have a clear-cut job in mind, but they should get into the habit of maybe life building and thinking about what could I do now in my younger years that will help me be a success later on, and what kind of life do I want to have? My father always gives me the advice. He suggests to spend big money on two things in life, your shoes and your mattress. He says that for one third of your life, you're in bed, or in the other half, you're on your feet. So if you have good shoes and a good mattress, you're set all the way. And I apply that kind of logic to career as well, because if you're in your career a lot, or you're thinking about it a lot, or you're preparing for it a lot, so you might as well make planning that one of the main jobs, rather than looking for just getting the great grades.
One thing I've heard is, like, in the United States, like, there used to be high school guidance counselors who would coach students on which career was best suited for them, but that's not, that actually, like, by the time I was in high school like graduating in 2004, they sort of got, they phased that out.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult job because it's very hard. You, first of all, you probably don't get enough time with each individual student to help them plan such a job like that. And in any case, how much time would you need to really get that right? So it's very difficult for any one person. What we aim to do as guidance practitioners is help the student to understand themselves so that as they develop, they're always ready to kind of move in the direction they want to go. So it's self-awareness rather than diagnostic, if that makes sense.
Do you have any thoughts on the Myers-Briggs personality test and also the OCEAN personality test? And do you think they could be helpful as a guideline to help people find a job that's suited for them?
I'm not so much Myers-Briggs, perhaps, but I certainly think any sort of self-awareness, self-reflective personality kind of tool is helpful for a student to kind of thought provoke and help them to think about themselves. I think the big five personality traits that they're
so the
about
big
as,
five that's the OCEAN.
Yes, exactly. So I think they're as good a quality as we've got to in psychology. So I think that would be a great place to start for any young person. And just to, even in personal dynamics with other people, it's kind of important to maybe recognize what they see in other people's personalities and how to relate to them.
We're close to the end of the show. William, do you have any upcoming projects, including your upcoming thesis that you want to plug?
My thesis will be kind of hoping to be published in October 2021. So I'm just trying to get these assignments in my MSc out of the way first, and then I can really concentrate on it. So I'd just encourage your listeners, if they're interested in anything else that I'll produce, to follow me on Twitter at Costello William. And just stay in touch. And I'm always looking to hear from anyone who has any interesting ideas. That's one of the positives about writing this article. It seems to have snowballed every week. Someone different wants to talk to me on a podcast like yourself or bring me on to some YouTube channel. So I've met some really interesting people. So that's been one really good positive.
William Costello, it's been an excellent show. Thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me. Keep in touch.